From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on October 9th, 2007. The Dow Jones Industrial Average hit its peak closing, 14,164. Home sales were breaking records. Books were being written about how the Dow was a rocket headed for 30K. The economy was booming, and the talking heads on CNBC were saying that these were the good times. Capitalism, America, new golden age. Everyone wins. It turns out not everyone. In the next year, everything fell apart. It turns out that some very smart people in the biggest Wall Street firms had cooked up some very terrible things. They chopped up subprime mortgage loans and hid the pieces in financial instruments that somehow were rated very highly, very safe. It was a scam, and it blew up. Millions of people lost their jobs or their homes or both. Most of the people who cooked up this scheme got out with lots of money and no jail time. For young adults in 2008, the millennial generation, this was a difficult way to enter the working world. Hiring shriveled up for a while. People lost faith in the markets. In 2007, nearly two-thirds of Americans owned stocks. Today, it's barely half. Those millennials are in their 30s now, and these should be their prime earning years. Their careers are supposed to be entrenched, but millennials have not been financially secure ever as a generation. 62% of millennials report living paycheck to paycheck last year. 66% of millennials have nothing saved for retirement. Home ownership is way down. Writing for Vox.com, Rainsford Stauffer says her generation has become the financial crisis generation. Stauffer notes that many millennials have done exactly what they were told to do. Work hard, be creative, plan your career. She writes, quote, "Even making smart decisions and picking a practical field did not matter. If we didn't out-responsibility the last recession, it feels extraordinarily unlikely that we can have enough savings to combat a pandemic given stagnant wages and job insecurity. Not even hustle culture and hyper-productivity can outrun economic circumstances from which we're still reeling. I'll keep worrying about health insurance, whether I'll be lucky enough to keep my job, whether my younger sister's generation will experience the powerlessness that stems from never really having power to begin with." End quote. Well, this pandemic hits millennials with their second devastating crisis. And millennials, the oldest, haven't even turned 40. How can an entire generation plan for a secure future and retirement when they've struggled to build anything? Our guests this hour include the author of that piece for Vox. She's a freelance writer and an author of the forthcoming book, An Ordinary Age. Welcome to Rainsford Stauffer. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me on.
It's great to have you. Welcome to Brittany Mollis, who's a freelance writer. Brittany, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Very good. And Holden Miller's with us. Holden's an operations coordinator at an appliance store, among other things, moonlighting as a landlord as well. Hi, Holden. How are you?
I'm doing well, Evan. Thanks.
Rainsford, I want to start with you. You wrote this piece for Vox, which I've seen posted just about everywhere because I think a lot of people can relate to it. So when you call this generation the financial crisis generation, how entrenched now is the view, you know, and I know you can't speak for every millennial, but how entrenched do you think the view is that whatever you do might not necessarily be enough?
I think because the millennial cohort is so diverse and in so many different situations, some are parents already, some are caretakers of their parents, some are living with roommates, some are trying to live alone, that there's no way to summarize a single experience that someone in the millennial generation might be having. But because so many millennials are now in their mid to late 30s, since it's a phase of life, and a generational cohort and not a phase of life like young adulthood is, for many, this isn't even as clear-cut as it being the second recession or second financial crisis that a millennial has experienced. It feels more like one ongoing financial crisis where the state of stagnant wages, the inability to secure a job or the right kind of job that you think will bring you that level of financial security, it's defined young adulthood as long as we've been adults. And for many, that began before they even graduated for college, and it's carried throughout adulthood. And now we're reaching a point where many millennials are starting to think about things, if they haven't already, like how they're going to take care of their older parents, how they're going to support their children, if they're ever going to be able to retire. And the result of that is that these things that we once considered milestones of adulthood, like having a substantial savings account or owning a house, just don't feel realistic.
I don't know, Rainsford. Maybe it's just too much avocado toast.
You know, it's funny how often those tropes still get thrown around, including, you know, I've seen everything from avocado toast, which is obviously something that's very attached to this kind of trope of the millennial. But there are a lot of people that think that all of this comes down to personal responsibility, that if you stop ordering coffee out, all of a sudden there's your down payment. You can pay off your medical debt. You can pay off your student debt. And I think what we're missing in this conversation is that these milestones aren't sustainable because of the way our systems and structures are set up. And I think the entire my generation had it worse, or millennials are particularly irresponsible, comes from the fact that people really want to be seen and recognized for having to exist in these systems that are largely failing everyone. And millennials have certainly been dealt a losing hand with this. It's defined adulthood. It's defined so many entry points into the workforce and into the economy. But it's affecting everyone. And it doesn't come down to all of your individual choices when the system is set up to allow you to fail.
Well, let me read a little bit from George Packer's piece writing for The Atlantic. He has a piece out today looking at all of the conditions that led this country to the current crisis moment, in which we don't really seem to have much of a way forward because of lack of leadership and sort of federal incompetence at a lot of different moments in the last 15 years. But he also touches on, Rainsford, what you just said here, which I think is important. Yes, we can focus on a 2008 crisis. Yes, we can focus on this recession and whatever it becomes. But here's what Packer writes, quote, "All of the lasting pain from 2008 was felt in the middle and at the bottom by Americans who had taken on debt and lost their jobs, homes, and retirement savings. Many of them never recovered, and young people who came of age in the Great Recession are doomed to be poorer now than their parents. Inequality, the fundamental relentless force in American life since the late 1970s, has grown worse," end quote. He's essentially saying what you just told us, which is for your generation, you don't necessarily view it as demarcated individual events. It's an ongoing challenge and maybe a realization that this is a generation that may end up poorer than their parents, which is not supposed to happen in this country.
Exactly. There's this idea of sort of the American dream, where every generation does a little bit better than the generation prior, and that's how we build our society. And what we found out is that so many of our societal structures just aren't sustainable. The cost of living has gone up. The cost of education has gone up. The amount of education we consider required to be a successful member of society has increased, which has its own ramifications in a negative way. But what hasn't changed is that we're still supposed to be doing all of these things and meeting all of these milestones that generations prior did, but in very different financial circumstances. And that's certainly not to minimize what other generations have gone through. I think that it's a bad trap to fall into to make this a contest of who has it worse, because really it's not working for anyone. And there are so many millennials now who are working multiple jobs. A significant portion of those jobs are contract work or in the gig economy. They're in industries like restaurant work and retail. And those are the industries that were already seen so profoundly impacted by coronavirus. And when we don't typically pay people a living wage anyway, somehow you're supposed to buy a house and have a savings account and find health insurance somewhere, and cutting out coffee is not going to change that.
Yeah, I mean, listeners, forgive my snark on this, but I mean, I think I have to agree with Rainsford Stauffer, our guest who wrote the piece for Vox.com that we've been sharing with you for the last few days, because, you know, in 2008, how many headlines did you see that said, well, J.P. Morgan Chase, you know, if you and your bankers would have just cut off those afternoon lattes and avocado toast, maybe you wouldn't have needed the TARP money. I didn't see any pieces saying the TARP money was because Goldman Sachs had an avocado toast problem. And that doesn't mean that we can't all learn financial responsibility and saving and what that looks like. But I think it's just become sort of a lazy way to kind of slur a generation that has been victimized by these circumstances. And so, listeners, if you want to share your thoughts, especially as we talk about this generation that's facing, you can call it a couple of crises or an ongoing crisis that could lead to a generation poorer than their parents, which, as we said, is not supposed to happen in this country. We'd love to hear your experience or your takes. If you want to call the program, it's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. Brittany and Holden are kind of just, you know, individual stories, but also, I think, illustrate the kind of challenge that a generation might have. And I'll start with Brittany on this. So, you know, as a freelance writer, but as someone who's sort of been in the gig economy now for a while, why don't you kind of take me back to where you were in that financial crisis, 07, 08, 09, what you thought the future might look like and what those ensuing years have looked like for you?
Sure. So like the author of this article, I was also in college during the first economic collapse, but it did sort of shift my career path because I always wanted to be a journalist. I wanted to contribute to society by informing and educating the masses, but I started to notice that that field might not be able to pay my bills. But, you know, once I graduated, I still gave it a shot, but I was only making $10 an hour and I was living by myself and, you know, the cost of gas and events I was covering ended up being more than the income I was making. So I had to go into the business avenue. So I chose copywriting. And then from there, I went into social media and marketing and all these different avenues of writing and content and all that. And for the past year, I've been freelancing mostly. And again, you talk about like hustle culture and side gigs. I've done everything from, you know, working at Target on weekends part-time. I do freelance writing projects for different businesses in my free time. I do podcasts in my free time. So like all of these things, it brings to a bigger problem that we have that millennials, not only are we broke and we're trying to figure out all different ways of making extra income because we're not making enough at like, you know, regular jobs, but also this burnout that we feel all the time. It leads to significant problems with mental health. So like, it's not just the financial issues that we're having. It's not just, you know, we're tired. We feel like we're always working, especially if you're doing something that involves social media. Like you always feel like you're working no matter what, even as you're sitting there in bed, scrolling through Instagram or Twitter. You know, you're still, you have to watch everything that you say. You have to be very careful of things that you say. If you're, it's a lot. And it always feels very heavy, especially now because you look down the road and you're like, okay, here we go again. Like the economy, you don't know how long this is going to last. You don't know how long it's going to take for the economy to pick back up. And you got to think of all these side gigs that you're not going to get anymore. And it's been exhausting.
Now, we talked briefly before the program about this, and if you don't mind, Brittany, I'd love for you to share your thoughts about the way that we talk, or I say we, sort of the collective we, whether it's on different platforms, social media, or just in regular reporting, the idea of being poor. Most people who legislate issues that relate to poverty have never been poor. Most people mm-hmm. in elected positions are twice your age and have never been poor. Most people probably writing for The Atlantic, the George Packers of the world, have not been poor. And I'm curious to know how you react when people talk about what it's like to be poor and generally your assumption of whether or not they really know what that feels like.
Sure. Just as a general rule of thumb, I don't like it when people act like an authority on something they've never experienced, whether that be, you know, being poor, impoverished, you know, any kind of, you know, like race issues. It really gets under my skin when people speak like an authority on these subjects when they haven't dealt with it. And like I said, I was responsible about going to college. I went to an affordable school. I lived at home, worked full time at a grocery store during it. I picked a profession that I thought would, you know, be able to support a living. Yeah, I went into business rather than following my real passion of journalism. I did everything right, but I still accumulated all this debt. And what that does is you then have to choose what bills you're going to pay for the month. You fall back on some bills, you fall back on some payments. And you know, when you talk about poverty, when I say like I've done all this, I'm educated, I did everything that I could in the right way. You know, I've been on Medicaid before as a professional. I'm an adult, I'm working, but like, I'm so poor, I've been on Medicaid. I've gone without eating. Like these are things that, you know, unless you've been there, you can't really speak on it. And then, you know, you see people saying, well, you know, not saying, but insinuating that $1,200 can go a long way. You're like, who are you to say that $1,200 can last, you know, 8-10 weeks? What is that?
And before I turn to Holden for his story, you know, your generation, Brittany, and, you know, I'm not that old, listeners. I'm almost a millennial. I'm technically Gen X. It's really close. But, you know, the interesting data on this generational divide is people who are especially under the age of 35, but really under the age of 25 in adulthood now in this country are much more likely to say they are suspicious of capitalism and they are open to either socialism, democratic socialism, social democracy, and its various forms. And Brittany, people like your parents might hear that and go, "Whoa, that's impossible." Are you surprised that this generation is more open to a change in system?
Not at all. You know, as we've talked before, you know, like I've always been a Biden supporter, but, you know, I totally understand why these Bernie supporters were so angry and they demanded change and, you know, the revolution and everything. And it's because, you know, you try to do everything right. You try to do everything by the book, everything that you're told. And here you are, you're stuck, you're poor, you're all these things that, you know, the author talked about, you know, marriage and careers and having kids and buying a house. These things just, they seem like an impossible dream now. So when you're in this system that is obvious, fundamentally broken in a lot of ways, it's not surprising that the pendulum is swinging back and you're like, okay, like older generations hear socialism and they get very scared and it's the worst thing that ever happened. But you look at different areas of the country where socialism has worked. Here in America, we have socialist programs that, you know, help people. So I think it's just a natural way. And I totally understand why it's come to this.
So Holden Miller is someone, if we want to start on the political thread, when the financial crisis of 2008 hit, you were in sort of a different politically ideological world at that point, weren't you?
Yeah. When Obama won the election in 2008, I went out and bought a gun because I was afraid that he was going to take our guns. And as I'm sitting here in my home office,
How old were you in 2008?
22.
And so you're going out to buy a gun because Obama's president. Okay, go ahead.
And I look out my window and I still have my Bernie sign out front.
That's a
big
change.
My politics have definitely changed in that time. And growing up kind of in a rural area in Genesee County, where, you know, I absolutely have an affinity for, buying a house and moving to Rochester really kind of opened up my eyes to how other people live. And so my experience through all of this it actually hasn't been hardship. I've actually done better and better each year as the time has gone on. And so I do have some of that kind of bootstrap mentality, but I also understand that I grew up in an area where I had other opportunities that other people didn't. And so living out here, I kind of see how the other half lives, and I've gotten to meet more people and coming from different backgrounds and seeing what they're going through. But, you know, going back to your when you first started, you read that quote and said we were going into a golden age. I would say that, you know, we've been in a gilded age, and we're in a new gilded age. And and you read those statistics about the 70s. I don't know if any of you have read Thomas Piketty's book, Capital in the 21st Century, but I read that in 2014, and that really opened my eyes about the income inequalities in this country and the structural things that have made it so hard for our generation to you know, really get ahead. And certainly there's stories, and I'm sure there's libertarians that are going to say, well, you know, I've been able to do this, and if you work hard, you can do that. And absolutely, there's absolutely people who can do that. But that level, that playing field is not level. It's not for everyone.
Okay, so let me ask you a few things about your mindset about that then. Generally speaking, do you agree or disagree with this? Do you agree or disagree that if you work hard and make the right choices, you will be fine in life?
I think that's kind of a blanket statement.
Not true for everybody.
It's hard to answer.
Not necessarily true.
Not true for everybody.
Okay. And for you to make this move in 12 years from 2008, Obama wins, you're so distraught as a 22-year-old that you're going out to buy a gun, to having a Bernie Sanders sign in your yard, a lot of people don't make that kind of move in their adulthood because belief and ideology are become part of our identity. And it's hard to sort of admit that either you think you were wrong or that you want to change. Was there a moment or an event? You talked about Piketty's book in 2014. Was that it, or were there other moments where you found yourself kind of looking at yourself differently?
My generation got sold on a bill of no goods, which is essentially go to college and do what you want. And so, you know, I feel that we don't recognize different intellects well enough in terms of trades and other ways of making a living. And so there was this huge pressure for everybody to go to college and go to school. And I essentially did house hacking, and I had roommates, and I would kind of see that they would have these 4-year degrees, and they'd essentially be working some other job that was completely unrelated in their field, because there wasn't the opportunity that was there for them. And so seeing them kind of struggle between car payment, car insurance, cell phone, and then on top of that, student loans, and they still have to pay rent. Like, how do you ever get ahead?
Listeners, it's 844-295-TALK. If you want to call the program, it's toll-free, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. Nicole writes to us on Twitter and says, Evan, your guest, and she was writing when Brittany was speaking, your guest is speaking my truth. I try to put into my savings, retirement, and Acorns accounts and eat at home, and I work full-time and a part-time job on the side, both of which are closed now due to COVID. I'm burned out from trying to help multiple members of my family. Can't ever catch up or can't ever catch a break. Rainsford, you want to respond to some of what you heard from Brittany and Holden and maybe let us know some of the feedback you've been getting since your piece hit Vox?
Absolutely. I think both of their perspectives illustrate this so well. And to the idea of the entitlement argument, you know, millennials are entitled and they've been spoiled, which is one that I hear a lot. I think one of the most interesting things that always happens when I get reader responses from pieces like this, or even just read what friends and acquaintances are posting on their own social media, is that I don't see many millennials complaining that they don't own a multi-million dollar mansion or that they're not going on vacation every other month. What I see is people distraught over the fact that they can't afford to pick up their prescriptions, or they're trying to decide between whether they're going to buy their child new shoes for school or if they're going to get groceries that month. And we shouldn't be making those choices in a society that's supposedly structured the way American society is. Of course, that there are always things that we can learn and do better about, but at some point, it turns back to the expectations that society is setting and the structures that enable things like low wages to continue to persist, even in light of changing financial times. I think burnout is such a relevant thing for so many young people. You can already see it happening in Generation Z as well, where there are already high schoolers that are concerned about saving for retirement because they think they're going to have to start that early just to even have a shot at getting ahead. And the fact that we're sitting there working full-time jobs or working multiple jobs that add up to more than full-time jobs and still feel like we're not doing enough just completely captures this idea that millennials don't feel like not only have we not been able to get ahead in society, we've barely been able to get started.
Let me read a little bit from your piece here, Rainsford, when you write about the gig economy. And you're citing the fact that gig workers, independent contractors, freelancers are experiencing income loss right now across the country because around the world because of COVID, without the support of severance or benefits, because we're still a country that ties health insurance to employment. And when millions of people are out of work, that means millions of people may not have health insurance. And all of a sudden, these problems can compound. And millennials, more than any generation besides maybe Gen Z coming into adulthood now, are living this way. Nearly half of millennials freelance, as Brittany was talking about, and almost half of millennials pursue side hustles of some kind to earn extra income. And so, Brittany, I think sometimes people hear that and they think, oh, okay, well, you know, you're teaching a class on the side or you're writing a piece on the side. But I think what older adults may not realize is a lot of millennials are cobbling together income entirely from the gig economy without anyone providing health benefits. What has been your healthcare situation? Can you kind of tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So there's only been probably a year or two of my life, my professional life, that I had healthcare at all. So when I was working full time in an office, I was a copywriter. And, again, I was the lead copywriter. I was only making $35,000 an hour, and I was supporting me and the person I was living with. You know, between everything, it was like, okay, I finally have health insurance. But there have been long periods of my adult life where I didn't have health insurance at all. Because it came down to, okay, do I pay for health insurance? And it's something that you never really think you're going to have to weigh. Like, okay, do I get sick enough that I need insurance? Whereas, I drive every day, so I need my car. I have to have a home, so I need, I need to be able to pay rent. I have to have utilities. And then it's so weird that the thought of health insurance, it's just like, okay, well, I guess that could go on the back burner now because I can't afford it. And, I mean, to even say that out loud in America, it's wild.
Brittany Mollis, our guest on the line, is a freelance writer. Holden Miller is an operations coordinator at an appliance store. And Rainsford Stauffer is a freelance writer and the author of the forthcoming book, An Ordinary Age. It was Rainsford's piece for Vox.com that got our attention as we take a look at the impact of yet another really massive financial and economic crisis that has hit the millennial generation, which came of age right when the financial collapse hit in 2008. If you're on the phone or if you've emailed, we've got a lot of your feedback. Let's take our only break of the hour, and we will get your phone calls and emails next. I'm Evan Dawson, Tuesday on The Next Connections. If you're unemployed, if you're a small business owner and you need help, have you been able to get it from the state government or from the federal government? If you're someone struggling with loan debt, what happens next? What about mortgage payments? Are the banks behaving appropriately? Looking at all the ways people are struggling, what comes next Tuesday? This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Hey, briefly, before we get to your phone calls, I want to let you know about an opportunity that you have to engage with local medical researchers about COVID-19. It's coming up this Thursday at 8 p.m. I'll be hosting a community forum with some of the top scientists from the University of Rochester Medical Center and Rochester Regional Health. They're, of course, at the forefront of vaccine development and treatment of COVID-19. So we're going to be talking about what are the possible paths to a vaccine. We're going to talk about what we know about antivirals. We'll talk to them about how they're fighting this disease and what their work means for you here and in our community. And we want to know what you'd like us to talk to them about. We want to know what's important to you. So you can send your questions about COVID-19 vaccines, treatment, research, and a possible path forward. And here's the email for that, for our Thursday night forum, forum@wxxi.org, forum@wxxi.org. You can call 585-209-3180. It's 585-209-3180. Or post comments, questions on Twitter or Facebook, tagging WXXI News, and we'll ask the experts your questions during that broadcast. You can watch the WXXI live forum, Fighting COVID-19, on WXXI TV, AM 1370. You can stream it on the WXXI News Facebook page and on the WXXI website. So all of our different platforms, Thursday night, 8 o'clock. Please be with us for that. First on the phones, Glenn in Honeyway. Go ahead, Glenn.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am slightly older than millennials, like you are.
Sure.
And I have 3 college degrees in mathematics, economics, and accounting. And while watching this, the impact of the coronavirus on our economy, I have come to understand that it isn't causing the problem, it is exposing the problem. Mm. I honestly believe that democratic socialism is the way to fix it at this point.
Well, so is it as simple as whom you vote for, or what are you talking to your friends and peers about in regards to what change would look like?
Who we vote for is how to get the changes into effect, unfortunately. Because the issues that I recognize is that when Reagan was in office, the ability for big companies, especially pharmaceutical companies, to lobby for changes in laws and to support... I'm sorry, I'm stumbling here.
It's okay, Glenn. It's all right. So let me just jump in.
Go ahead. To support senators in their election campaigns has caused the wages to stagnate for the lower class and middle class, but CEOs' incomes to skyrocket.
Yeah.
And it's that major wage gap that is one of the causes for this problem.
Yeah. Glenn, thanks for the phone call. I'll kick it to our guests for them to respond, and I will point out that Glenn's point about the wage gap between average CEOs, and this isn't everybody. I mean, every time we talk about this, small business owners will contact us, and I respect that, and they'll say, look, not everyone who owns a business is wealthy. I get it. I definitely understand that. But when we look on the average, this is not just a last 10 years, last 12 years problem. This really goes back to the mid-70s. And the shift was profound since, well, really the last 45 years or so. But it hasn't really gotten better even in the last 10 to 12 years, as one of our guests, Rainsford Stauffer, was writing about and George Packer was writing about in The Atlantic today. It has continued to get worse even when Democrats have been in power. And let me kick it over to Holden first. What do you make of Glenn's remarks there?
Sounds like neoliberalism right there, talking about even while Democrats are in power, you know, that further shift of the left going to the center. But, you know, I obviously agree with the caller and what he had to say. But thinking back to what Brittany was saying about, you know, the bills that being paid. So the constructs or the principles that Gen X's or boomers had of, you had a car payment and you had to live somewhere and you had to live on ramen noodles and all that stuff, that still applies. That hasn't necessarily gone away, but it's what Glenn was talking about wage stagnation, and the your dollar just doesn't go as further as it used to. So it's not as easily obtainable.
What do you think, Rainsford?
Absolutely. I think that, as Glenn, I believe, pointed out, this is just going to deepen inequity for the most vulnerable people among us. And so if you're already in a precarious financial position or a precarious personal position, COVID is just going to amplify that. And I think one of the things that we're seeing in the coverage of this pandemic is the fact that the people experiencing these things aren't surprised. These problems have always been there. And now that we're talking about another financial crisis and all of this financial setback because of businesses closing, because of people being unable to go to work, we're finally having the conversation that I think people have been having amongst themselves for a very long time.
You wrote in your piece, as Glenn was pointing out, you know, Glenn's about my age, maybe just outside the millennial generation. But you also wrote about Gen Z in your piece, Rainsford. You said the generation after millennials, it seems, won't be much better off. College-age Gen Z kids are graduating into a pandemic with financial side effects nearly impossible to fathom. A recent poll found that Gen Zers, people currently between the ages of 8 and 23, according to Pew, are three times more likely to report losing their jobs or being put on leave as a result of the coronavirus, and many are watching their planned post-grad jobs or paid internships disappear before they've even gotten their diploma. And so, Rainsford, you know, I think we're looking at young adults. We have to stop saying that, you know, millennials are all adults. I mean, millennials are, I think, 24 to 39, something like that. So the newest American adults are largely in the same boat, yes?
Exactly. And I think that they're experiencing a very similar sensation of powerlessness that millennials experienced, where you're graduating into circumstances beyond your control. In a case for a lot of these young people, both Generation Z and millennials, they tried to do a lot of things right. And there are studies that show that Generation Z really did try to learn from what happened to millennials. They paid attention to things statistically, like practical majors and not taking on too much college debt. And I think what we're seeing again and again sort of constantly repeat itself is that you can do everything right. You can go to the right school with low debt, not take out student loans. You can work your way through college the way so many millennials I know did, the way so many Generation Z individuals are doing, and it still not be enough. And that's incredibly frustrating because it promotes this notion that you can put it all back on yourself, that if you've done something differently, that if you change just that one thing, that that would be the game changer. And what we're starting to see now is the generation coming up behind millennials is going to repeat a version of this same scenario, which points to the fact that there's some systemic issues we need to look at. It's not just the individual choices of a single generation.
I have a flood of feedback. We'll get as much as we can before the end of the hour. Zach and Arondakoit next. Go ahead, Zach. Hey, Zach, are you there? Let's do this. Zach, I'm going to put you back on hold, and I'll take Jane in Rochester next, and we'll see if we can get Zach back. Hi, Jane, go ahead.
Yes. Someone said, Jimmy Carter, many people have said this, but Jimmy Carter was asked about our democracy, and he said, we have an oligarchy now. We do not really have a democracy. So that came from him. And I think that's been a big change because these people have misused their power, creating the derivatives, exotic products, subprime mortgage. They're too big to fail. And we just seem to have taken it. And I don't know how to explain that. We lost Glass-Steagall. But that's basically all of that is with the banking. But we were also lied to about globalization, and I can remember this very clearly. They were saying, we will transfer the labor-intensive jobs to Asia and so forth, all over there. And the more demanding jobs, technical, professional, we will retain here. So we will benefit, America will benefit financially from this. And that's not been what's happened. It's as though we have no jobs here. There's been so much outsourcing with the globalization. So where do you go when the banking debacles, to me, are planned? They know very well what they're doing. And the last one worked. And I remember talking about that, too, with some other people. And the question was, well, will it happen again? And I said, yes, because it worked. Mm. So, and, you know, you've even said that to you at times when you say, well, if something works, it increases the likelihood that they will try it again. So, anyway, that's just what I have to say. Enjoying your program.
Jane, thank you for the phone call. And to Jane's point, by the way, about jobs, If you're thinking, well, before the pandemic, you know, we had low unemployment, we really didn't here. And I don't think I or really journalists in general, and I'll put myself in this category, do a very good job of reporting on unemployment. If people have dropped out of the workforce or really even looking for work, it's the labor pool. And we've had about a 40-year low in adult Americans who describe themselves as even trying to find work. So if you're not even trying to find work, if you've given up, you don't get counted as unemployed. It's a pretty good way to game the thing. And it's not just, by the way, this administration that's done that. It happened under the Obama administration. It happens with just about every administration. But the best way to look at unemployment is not just the unemployment rate, to Jane's point. But let me read a very different kind of comment that came in from a listener who is in Jane's generation. This is what Alex says, and I'll ask all three of our guests about this. Alex says, of course, being poorer than the previous generation doesn't make you poor necessarily. Millennials live better than the rich of just 200 years ago. It's all relative and it's all mindset. It's not the hand you're dealt, but how you play it. It's the consequence of the everyone gets a trophy generation. I can't have everything, so now I'm sad. Well, let's cowboy up and press on. All right, Holden, what would you say to Alex?
I would say, okay, buddy, keep pulling up your bootstraps. I guess you're doing all right. You know, that doesn't necessarily apply to everybody. And his lived experience, one man's lived experience, doesn't necessarily dictate how everybody else should be, right?
No. Yeah, listen, I'm with you there. I'm sort of gritting my teeth here because, you know, this idea that, you know, that, well, if 200 years ago you'd be living better than kings is interesting as far as it goes, but it sort of just ignores the fact that people are actually hurting. And Brittany, what do you think?
Okay, so here's what I think. You know, when you hear people say we complain too much or we have a sense of entitlement, we don't want to work hard, lazy, whatever. Like, we've all heard all of this before. And it really what it comes down to is we just want what's fair, or at least, you know, a chance at something being fair. You know, for example, my father and I, we went to the same college, right? I graduated in 2012. He graduated sometime in the 80s. So it's like, you know, 20, 25, whatever year difference. My total cost of tuition was $45,000. Maybe, you know, you have to add on interest because I had to do it all by loans because my parents were both middle class, you know, full-time workers, couldn't save anything up for college because they lived paycheck to paycheck my entire life. But his entire cost of college when he was there for 10 years cost $4,000. So you look at, you see things like that and you're like, okay, the cost of college has become completely outrageous and people are profiting from this. And we're being straddled with all of this debt that we can't get out of. Like, I'm probably going to be paying on student loans for the rest of my life, and I understand that. But, you know, when I hear people argue against, you know, eliminating student loan debt or, you know, giving some sort of relief, and they're like, well, I had to pay mine. So people have this mindset that if it doesn't help me, then I don't want to do it. Instead of looking at this as, like, an investment into our future, because, you know, let's not forget that we very much are the future. The economy is very much going to rely on us. And, you know, if we can't ever get ahead, if we can't ever buy houses or, you know, have kids, all of this stuff that, you know, the generation before us did, because we're tied to so much debt, how are we going to help anyone?
Yeah, and I would just also say to Alex, it's the consequence of the everyone gets a trophy generation, Alex says. Well, first of all, I don't necessarily believe that stuff. I think that's sort of a silly stereotype. But let's say you actually believe it. Okay, Alex, who raised those kids? You did. You're the one, dude. You're the one who said
who
everybody
gave us
needs
the
kids.
Trophies?
Yes, it was you guys. It wasn't the millennials who
give
made
them a trophy,
you.
Yeah.
Come on. Like, you open yourself up to the easiest criticism. Alex follows up, by the way, to say the universe is not fair. Well, that's true. The universe is not fair, but we are sentient beings, and we can decide that it's probably a good idea if we can adhere to a standard of fairness as best as we can create it. And right now, all they're saying, Alex, is that working hard and trying to play by the rules doesn't necessarily lead to success. And that feels fundamentally unfair in a way that most generations have never had to experience. Rainsford, you want to add to that? Go ahead.
I think your point about participation trophies is dead on, and it's one that I think about a lot, because if this is the generation that demands awards for everything and wants to be praised for everything, we weren't the ones handing out those participation trophies. And I think where this argument kind of falls flat is it pushes the idea that this is as good as it's going to get, and so we're all supposed to tolerate it and kind of carry on business as usual. I think about the generation behind us, the people who are graduating into a pandemic, into a job market that's going to be affected by that, the kids that are in school after them, watching all of this, watching their parents struggle and going, oh no, what chance do I have? I think we have a responsibility to try and make it better for the people that come after. And I think that when we share our experiences and when we start talking openly about what aren't just personal issues, but are really fundamental issues of equity, we stand a chance at making things better. And I think kind of the fundamental gap in that argument for me is that wanting to make things better and pointing out inequity is complaining. To me, those aren't the same thing. I think it's perfectly logical to look at the systems we have that have set us up with student debt or medical debt, which is completely out of someone's control, mm-hmm. and say, hey, something's not right about this. Something's not adding up. This isn't the way that this should work for anyone, not just me, but for anyone. I think that that's how things get better. I think that's how we can take care of each other.
All right, let me get Zach and Aranda. We'll try this again. Go ahead, Zach.
Hey, Evan, thank you so much for having me on your show.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just wanted to share some of my experience. I'm 33 right now, and how that experience has shaped my political views. I was in college right during that financial collapse. As that happened, I saw my father who was about to retire as a district manager at CVS. He got fired and robbed of retirement and his pension and all that, and had to go on a few years after that working, you know, smaller positions around different retailers. My brother is in pharmaceutical sales doing really well, and he got fired as well. And then as I graduated, you know, I had to take on a lot of short and long-term, I'm a teacher, short and long-term subbing positions just on contract with no security. As I went in to get my master's, I had a few years without health insurance, you know, and all through that, I was taking my master's courses at nights and weekends, working at Wegmans and subbing. And then once I finally got my master's, I think to Holden's point, it's, you know, everyone works so hard, I think, across the generations, but it does have a lot to do with privilege, even just location and the profession. And I particularly have an educator's lens. So really lucky to be in an affluent district here right outside of Rochester in a suburb. And, you know, to have the New York State Union, but still, you know, we know there's more layoffs coming for the city. I know my district's current budget for next year is already millions light, and they're already announcing cuts on teachers and tenured teachers. So, and I know a lot of teachers in the right to work states have it a lot, you know, really hard there as well. You know, and then just in comparison, it's not necessarily, I believe in Bernie and democratic socialism, but I think it's just unchecked capitalism because I've seen it work. My dad was in the Army in the late 60s. He went to school at Albany. You know, he had a great job right out of college and graduated without debt, you know. But now there's people like Betsy DeVos defunding education and things like that. All that experience has really led me to want more of a systematic change.
Well, Zach, thanks for that. So on Zach's note there, let me ask all three of our guests. Holden, if you're not happy with the state of, you know, sort of, I don't know if egalitarianism is the right word, or unfairness as it pertains to the generational challenge, especially that the millennials are facing and eventually Gen Z, what's step one to rectifying that? I mean, is it voting? Is it systemic change? Is it something else? Holden?
Well, I think what we're doing right here, I think having the conversation is a good starter. And how do we change it into more tangible ideas, you know, or actions? I guess I'd have to rely on people smarter than myself that know how to do organizing and make the political, you know, get the political power that can make that happen. And, you know, that was one of the reasons why I supported the Bernie movement. But I just wanted to say quick, we both know Leah Stacey. We both grew up in Bergen. And I think Leah is a great example of somebody that has gone through this and how we finally get to this place of some stability. And then it just kind of gets ripped out from us. And her and I just caught up recently, and we talked about how we have to keep reinventing ourselves. And we're in survival mode so many times. And what would be nice is if we could get to a more thriving or living mode, because we live in the one of the richest countries in the world. Why is that not possible for our populace?
All right, Brittany, what's the first step to making the change you want to see?
Well, like Holden said, I think number one is just being able to have conversations with each other again. It feels like now in our society, it's impossible to just have, you know, civil discourse with people. And everyone's always so obsessed with being right and proving people wrong. And, you know, that takes away any kind of progress that we can make together. And, you know, just being able to sit down and say, and empathize, you know, somewhere along this, we lost the ability to be empathetic or considerate of other people. And, you know, I think it's very important that we talk to people that we don't agree with, try to understand their side of things, see how we could find some common ground and work together. And then, you know, once that those conversations start taking place, eventually, you know, voting is obviously very important. But it's going to take a lot more than what we have now. You know, I think now you have, with the election coming up, you have Biden there. But I think he's going to, you know, implement a lot of, you know, Bernie's different platforms to try and get people on board with that. So, you know, it just takes some listening and being willing to work together and finding the things that you have in common, things that you could work together on.
Mm-hmm. Rainsford, what do you think? About 45 seconds.
I think there's a lot. I think one of the biggest things we can do is that we need to reconfigure this idea of entitlement, wanting accessible health care, wanting an equitable wage. Those things aren't being entitled. And to echo everything that Brittany and Holden said, I think that the fact that we need to be talking about this openly is so relevant and so important. And I think it ties right into our political process. Of course we need to vote. Of course we need to amplify the work of local organizers who are doing great on the ground work to push progressive policy and to make things better in our communities. But I think the biggest thing we can do is talk to each other and share these stories of inequity and how it manifests and how privilege manifests in different communities, because we don't want to get caught in a conversation of who has it worse. We want to be able to make things better.
Well, the piece for Vox that Rainsford wrote that got our attention was Millennials Are Being Hit with Another Recession Thanks to Coronavirus. Rainsford, thanks for taking the time to join us and for sparking these conversations. Great stuff.
Thanks so much.
Brittany Mollis is a freelance writer. Good luck to you, and thanks for making time for the program today.
Thanks for having me.
Holden Miller, operations coordinator in an appliance store. Thanks for making time and for sharing your experience as well, Holden. Thank you.
Thanks, Evan, and shout out to Joe Henderson and my squad.
And for everybody listening today, and I hope every afternoon right here on Connections, we're so grateful to have you. It's a wonderful team still doing the work every day. MRA Stein is the intern. Megan Mack is the producer. Rob Braden is the engineer. Thanks to Barsook Records for the music. I'm Evan Dawson. Talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.